So John Tracy Fox from Taylorsville, North Carolina, welcome back to the show. How's the job search going?
The job search still about the same. There's not a whole lot of work around here.
13 months looking for construction work, and the construction business is still pretty much of a mess in your area, right?
Yes, it is.
So, John, what if you just moved your family to where the jobs actually are?
Well, that's always an idea of something you could do if it was affordable, but the housing industry upside down, it's kind of hard to move.
You'd have to sell your home, right?
Yes.
And it would actually cost you to move, right?
Yes.
So add it up for me, if you could. How much would it cost you to just pack everything up in your old kit bag and get out of town?
A lot more than what my net worth's worth.
You're laughing there, but it's too expensive to move. Well, smile, John. Smile, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Smile, that's the style on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, April 23rd. I'm John Hockenberry, and Catherine Lamprey is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, John. In this hour of the show, we're also going to talk transit with our correspondent, Andrea Bernstein. Also, GM steering closer to bankruptcy, and we look at how the wind blows in a new energy policy. Thank you. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
General Motors will close most plants for 9 weeks this summer. According to sources who spoke with the Associated Press, GM won't publicly announce the plan until workers have been told the specifics. Economist Peter Morici says GM is on the brink of bankruptcy.
A lot of General Motors' older models compete with Chrysler models. They have to clear them out. Couple that with the fact that they can't make their bond payment on June 1st, the day after their federal financing is scheduled to expire.
But workers will get paid under union contracts. They will get most of their pay even if they're not required to work. President Obama meets with leaders of the credit card industry today to push for more consumer protection. Do you have any suggestions for them? We'll be talking about that a little bit later. Critics call the industry's fees and interest policies abusive. Catherine?
Pakistan paramilitary platoons rushed to the northwest city of Bunir today, where they encountered enemy fire. There are reports that Taliban militants took control of the city, which is near the northwestern Swat province, already under their control. Earlier this month, the Pakistani government agreed to impose Islamic law in Swat in a deal with the Taliban. And some breaking news. Iraqi officials say a suicide bomber struck a Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad. At least 22 dead, more than 50 people injured. Among those hurt, civilians who were collecting humanitarian aid.
The ANC has a lead in the South African elections. Ballots are being counted. 80% of the 23 million registered voters showed up at the polls. The FDA overturned a Bush administration policy yesterday and will offer the morning-after pill soon will be available over-the-counter to 17-year-olds. The Dow fell about 1% yesterday. It opens at 78.87. The S&P begins trading at 8.44. So we mentioned the credit card companies a moment ago. The administration and Congress are going to take on the credit card companies and see if there's some sort of regulatory regime to regulate those fees you may be seeing in your bills. What are you seeing in your credit card bills? Lots of you have been calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org with credit card stories.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Catherine Lamfer, and we begin with some alarming developments in Pakistan. Taliban militants have established control of a strategically important district inside Pakistani territory, but it's not in some obscure northwest province up in the mountains somewhere. It's 70 miles from the capital, Islamabad. Joining us now is BBC correspondent Jonathan Marcus from London. Jonathan, this raises the issue of civil war in Pakistan, yes or no?
Well, not so much civil war, but there is clearly already a major insurgency going on in the country. It's yet another step in the Talibanization, as you might call it, of insurgent and radical groups there. This, of course, comes hard on the heels of effectively a Taliban takeover in the nearby Swat district, where the Pakistani government has allowed the Taliban to apply their form of Sharia law. They'd hoped that would stem the advance of these groups, but very clearly it hasn't, and they've taken over the neighboring Bunair province as well, Bunair district as well.
Well, here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday directly to the Pakistani government, raising an issue that sounds a little bit like I told you so if we look at the battlefield today. Listen, Jonathan.
We cannot underscore the seriousness of the existential threat posed to the state of Pakistan that are being made by a loosely confederated group of terrorists and others who are seeking the overthrow of the Pakistani state.
It seems like the Secretary of State there, Jonathan Marcus, is saying you appease the Taliban and this is what happens. They're trying to overthrow you.
I think she's very clearly saying that. She's also trying to reach out perhaps over the heads of the authorities in Islamabad to liberal Pakistanis, not just inside Pakistan, but in the diaspora as well, saying, look, the existence of this state is under threat. You cannot keep making these kinds of concessions to groups that are taking over more and more territory inside the country. It really highlights, I think, the difficulties the Obama administration has in inheriting this dossier from the Bush team. What began as an Afghanistan policy, at the end of last month, President Obama announced an AFPAC policy, seeing Afghanistan and Pakistan, the crises in these two countries, being inextricably bound together. Increasingly, though, I think it is Pakistan that is causing the most concern in Washington. And one has to say that the levers that the Americans have to try and remedy the situation are relatively limited. And even the levers that they are applying, if they're going to work, are going to take some considerable time to bear fruit. And time is not on Washington's side.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the territory that's been threatened. Bunir province is home to, or Bunir district is home to about 1 million people. It's near a major Pakistani city, Mardan. Explain what's going on in this particular territory and why it's strategically important.
Well, it's a sign of the Taliban, as you said, moving ever closer to the capital, only Islamabad, only some 70 miles away. But as I said earlier, I think it shows, it's an indication that the Pakistani government's efforts to contain this insurgency by making really quite fundamental political concessions to the Taliban is not working. We know that the authorities in Islamabad have dispatched additional frontier force, paramilitary forces to the area. It sounds as though these may well be the forces that have been intercepted and ambushed. It's not entirely clear from the news today. But of course, what the Americans are looking for, what the British government, what many of the outside allies of Pakistan are looking for, is a much more concerted military effort against the insurgency inside the country. And it just seems at the moment that Pakistan neither has the will nor necessarily the means to take the sort of action that's required.
Oh, quickly, Jonathan, Peshawar is the largest city in Northwest Frontier Province. Mardan is the second largest. Bunir, as I said, has about 1 million people in it. Here's a quote from a media report. A law enforcement official in Northwest Frontier Province, a Pakistani official who spoke on condition of anonymity, said, they take over Bunir, then they roll into Mardan, and that's the end of the game. Senior law enforcement official describing essentially an end game for the fall of Pakistan. Do you buy that?
I don't think it's quite that dramatic, but that would not be to understate the seriousness of this. I don't think we're in any sense the end game leading to the fall of Pakistan, but developments are very worrying indeed. And as Secretary Clinton herself made clear, this is an existential problem relating to the state of Pakistan, and nobody should try to minimize it.
Well, thanks as always. BBC correspondent Jonathan Marcus joining us from London. Thank you, Jonathan.
All right, John, you ready for a turn here?
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Let's hear this.
With 31 and a half years seniority, I feel that I really have no more sense of security than when I started over 30 years ago. I mean, it's pretty scary.
That's GM worker Terry Harden. We spoke with him a few weeks ago. But the bad news for him is that the latest chapter from General Motors could show the car maker edging closer to bankruptcy. That's because of recent news that the company doesn't plan to pay the $1 billion it owes bondholders by June. Also, the news we're hearing this morning that GM is going to shut down most of its factories in the U.S. for up to 9 weeks, starting as early as next month. In addition, we also have news about Chrysler, saying if they don't get more money, they're going to go into de facto liquidation. We're going to go now to Nick Bunkley. He's joining us from Detroit. He writes about the auto industry for our partners at the New York Times. All right, Nick, let's start with Chrysler. They're facing a deadline next week to meet the demands of the Obama administration, including that merger with Fiat. What's it look like now?
Well, this is definitely a critical week here in Detroit, and that comes knowing that, that basically every week for the past 6 months or so has felt like that. But we're basically staring at the end of this month, coming next Thursday, and if Chrysler doesn't have a deal with Fiat and doesn't have a deal with its unions and its lenders to meet all the administration's demands, they have said basically that they may not be able to go any further.
Yeah, you mentioned the UAW. The clock is ticking. What's the choice before them?
Well, they certainly already feel like they've made a lot of sacrifices, but they're going to need to make some more, and they're trying to hold out as long as they can. Especially while these talks are going on simultaneously with the lenders, because neither one of these groups wants to be the first to step forward and make more sacrifices. But both of these groups are going to have to finally just agree to something in the next week, and both of them are going to have to give up quite a bit.
I want to talk for a minute about the GM closure of their U.S. factories, for almost all of their U.S. factories for 9 weeks. There's some confusion, at least there was earlier this morning, about whether this is going to happen or not. What are you hearing?
Well, I think it's certainly likely that they'll be idling a lot of their plants for number of weeks, whether it's actually nine, as the word seems to be, or more or less. A lot of that depends on just what the company looks like after June 1st, when they have their deadline, similar to Chrysler, to make these deals and get the extra money that they're hoping for from the government. At this point, though, they really can't do too much to show the government that they're making cuts and putting themselves in a better position, and every week that their plants are down, it just helps their dealers go through some of their inventory, stop having to discount their vehicles so much. And of course, when you talk about summer production, that's the last few months of the current model year, so these dealers don't want to have really any 09 models left by the end of the summer when the 2010s start rolling out.
I want to go back for a minute to the UAW workers, because don't they, under their contract, get most of their salary anyway, even if the factories are shut down?
Well, they get unemployment benefits from their state, and then GM would also pay them a supplemental benefit that covers a lot of the difference between unemployment and what they would normally make. So they will get the majority of what they would get if they were working. And although that does sound like a pretty good deal for a lot of them, it's still not their full salary. And a lot of them do say they would rather be out there working, because the more they're not working, the more they also know that in the future they could not be working permanently.
What are the popular models that are affected by this closure if it should take place, and where are those plants quickly?
Well, we don't know exactly which plants would be shut down, but it's easy to make some guesses. And the SUVs are certainly going to be affected. A lot of those are built down in Arlington, Texas, so I'm sure the workers there are feeling that they're probably going to be among those having a longer summer vacation. And across the passenger cars, and really regardless of size, not much is selling these days either. It's not even just the smaller cars that are moving quickly because gas prices are getting lower than they were last summer.
All right, Nick, we're going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. Nick Bunkley writes about autos for the New York Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in for Adora Udoji. President Obama is taking on the credit card companies today, but you have to do it every day. So go ahead, tell us your story of being credit crunched. What have the companies done to you lately? What kind of sticker shock do you get when you open up that envelope?
Hi, this is Michael in New York. One thing no one ever brings up is, why are credit card companies charging people 30% interest rates on their credit cards? They're hitting everybody over the head with a hammer every time they're a day late, and no one says anything to protect the consumer in that area.
Well, what if you had a hammer? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us
I'd
at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hammer in the evening. So where did Joe Biden spend his Earth Day yesterday? The vice president was at a bus depot in Maryland outside of D.C.
We've heard for years that a greener economy will benefit our grandkids who are going to inherit a cleaner planet. We know that. We know that in our gut. That's true. But that's not the whole story. Building a green economy is for us, too, right now, today, here.
Nobody messes with Joe.
Well, they might be. Sometimes when the vice president chairs an event, you might think that it's not the most important thing in the administration. The Obama administration yesterday had Joe Biden talking about a clean bus program, the second time in a week that the Obama administration has addressed mass transit. Andrea Bernstein joins us, Takeaway correspondent. Andrea Bernstein, gosh, I haven't talked to you in a while. It's great to welcome you back to the program, Andrea. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
When the vice president chairs an event, maybe sometimes it isn't the most important thing. Is this a big job for Joe Biden yesterday?
Well, you know, you got to read the tea leaves carefully on this. The Obama administration had a bit of a slow start on transit and got some blowback from environmentalists, transit activists. And, you know, what do people usually do on Earth Day? Oh, they go to a lake, they go to a field, they plant a tree. Wind turbines, where the president was yesterday, has become the, you know, issue du jour for environmentalists on Earth Day. But to go to transit is sort of really pushing the ball down the field. And it's an acknowledgement that to solve the environmental problem, you not only have to have cleaner fuels, you don't have to have more people with access to cleaner fuels, but you also have to have less people driving, because that's where most of the greenhouse gases come from.
So how did Biden suggest this was going to be addressed, by cleaning up buses or actually making more of them?
Well, he announced yesterday $300 million in Recovery Act funds for a clean cities program. And this is a Department of Energy program, not actually a transit program. It's an energy program that will buy hybrid buses and clean fleets for cities around the country. Now, of course, you know, all this Recovery Act stuff is not new money. It's all part of the $800 billion package we already know about. But it was an opportunity to highlight this and to say this is what we want to do. And, you know, you could hear Biden at that bus depot yesterday. He was getting pretty excited about this stuff. Listen to this.
This program, the Clean Cities program, is in its 15th year. Already it's saved 2 billion gallons of petroleum used since its inception. And now it's time to ramp it up. Ramp it up in a big way. We know it works.
Yeah, he sounds pretty excited there. A lot of people don't know that the
getting a little breathless.
The Senate Foreign Relations.
Nobody messes with Joe.
That's right. I mean, he's, you know, big on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, big on the Judiciary Committee, but he's also a big Amtrak customer here. What's going on with Joe now?
You know,
is he rebranding himself?
It's so fascinating because, you know, last summer when he was selected vice president, I mean, you know, he was the guy that was going to help out with the 4 a.m. phone call about Pakistan and or North Korea. He was the eminence grise.
Right.
You know, that was why everybody was like, yes, Joe Biden, Joe Biden. You know, he fits in Obama's vulnerability. But, you know, nobody envisioned then that Hillary Clinton would be Secretary of State. And now that both she and Barack Obama are taking the calls in the middle of the night, you know, Joe Biden has a bit of a new territory to carve out. And one of the things that he's been doing is really, you know, taking on transit. Now, you know, it is a natural fit. He's known as the guy who took Amtrak every day. But, you know, he's done stuff like he went to St. Cloud, Minnesota to a hybrid bus factory there where actually a lot of orders are going to be coming in under the Recovery Act because a lot of what people are doing with their transit money is this. He's been going to Amtrak stations. He's been holding these weekly Recovery Act cabinet meetings. It's become a major item in his portfolio. And it's a, you know, it's, I wouldn't say it's a U-turn, but I don't think it's quite what people envisioned was going to be the big thing that Joe Biden was going to be doing when he was selected.
Well, let's talk policy for a moment. I mean, what would transit advocates say shows that the Obama administration is really serious about a new national transit program that has some real teeth to it? I mean, we've heard a lot of talk on the stimulus package going to roads, which basically benefits car drivers, not necessarily bus drivers.
You know, I would say that up to now, there has been mostly disappointment among people who care about mass transit in the Obama administration. People felt that the Recovery Act only had $8 billion. Now, that's $8 billion, but it's $8 billion out of $800 billion. So that's 1%, and that's all the money for transit. And they were saying, you know, that isn't enough money. It doesn't show a real commitment. You can't really change things with that. And indeed, as this money has been doled out, what we're finding is that, you know, what states are doing with it is they're not exactly rebuilding not building a 21st century infrastructure. They're rebuilding the 20th century infrastructure.
I mean,
you know, fixing things.
They're filling
right.
potholes. I mean, I actually spent lunch
or
yesterday.
Rebuilding bridges. You're talking Minnesota.
Right. But still, again, it's not change. It's not visionary. It's repair work. I was talking with a bunch of architects yesterday at lunchtime, and they were describing how down in Sao Paulo in Brazil, they're building 120 miles of new tunnels for a mass transit system. We're doing nothing like that here in the United States, Andrea.
Nothing at all under this bill. Now, the reason that people are getting a little excited now, just a little bit, like their hearts are starting to beat a little faster, is because next month in the Congress, there will be this giant transit authorization bill that's coming up. And this happens every 6 years, so it, you know, doesn't quite parallel the length of an administration. And it's tons of money for roads and what they're hoping is that this time around, there'll be tons of money for transit. So when they begin to see the administration talking about high-speed rail, when they begin seeing the administration talking about, you know, mass transit going, as Joe Biden did yesterday, to a transit station for his Earth Day thing, they're thinking, okay, so maybe this administration is going to put some serious muscle behind this as this reauthorization fight comes up. And I'm speaking to a lobbyist from NRDC who has expressed great disappointment up to now. And he said, you know, I think things, you know, may be beginning to turn. We'll see. It's an uphill battle, though,
because those highway lobbies and those places around the country that want their highway money are powerful, powerful folks.
Yeah, it's true. And it is a battle, and it's a battle about getting people out of their cars and changing their whole lifestyle. But as they point out, you know, this is where most of the carbon footprint's coming. It's
right.
from driving.
Well, and telling us what to watch as we look at this bill coming down the pike on roads and bridges and hopefully mass transit. Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway Correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you. Now I'm going to go out and charge something.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Coming up, the forecast for wind energy in America. First headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello, good morning. The time is 32 minutes past the hour. Just getting in some new jobless claims figures. And jobless claims have risen to 640,000. And the continuing claims now top 6.1 million. Credit cards are on President Obama's agenda today. He's meeting with representatives of the industry and backing tough legislation to regulate it. Both the House and Senate are looking at credit card bill of rights to prevent the amount that companies can raise interest rates. The president will also meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Yesterday, she told Congress that Pakistan had let the Taliban go too far. This morning, Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S., Hassan Haqqani, responded to Secretary Clinton's remarks.
With all due respect to the Secretary of State, the government of Pakistan has not abdicated its responsibility. There has been no attempt at appeasement. Basically, we have used some tactical moves at local level in places like Swat, and we will see the outcome. If we feel that we need to go back to fighting, we will.
Militants have already gained control over one northern region of Pakistan and are now pushing deeper into another, the Bunir district, 70 miles from the capital. At home, the Transportation Department is abandoning a proposal to keep reports of birds colliding with planes confidential. That's what brought down the US Airways Flight 1549 into the Hudson River just a few months ago. Now, in the past, it was up to airports and airlines to disclose the information. And finally, a South Carolina wildfire has spread towards a very busy tourist area after destroying about 40 homes. Now, around about 2,500 people have been evacuated from North Myrtle Beach and shelters have been set up. No reports of any injuries. Let's look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
All right, John, you know what this sound is. But how about this one? That, my friend, is the sound of energy, of wind turbines.
Wind turbines. Oh, wow. You know, they say they could power this station if they just put a wind turbine in front of my mouth here.
I'm not going to disagree with that. you know, so the next time you go to the seashore, that is a sound that you might be hearing. Right. Now, yesterday, the Obama administration and the Department of Interior announced new rules to boost the development of offshore wind farms along our coastlines. Now, how does the wind blow? This is your cue to make a little sound. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to turn now to Amy Myers Jaffe. She is the Associate Director of the Rice University Energy Program and a fellow at the James A. Baker Institute for Public Policy. Hey, Amy, how much energy are we talking about when it comes to wind? I mean, how much is this really going to ramp up the influence of wind when it comes to our energy production?
Well, you know, when you hear people give estimates, you can hear every estimate to the fact that we could manufacture all of the electricity we need through wind, to people saying, you know, 10 or 20%. But I think the thing we need to remember when we think about wind is what we call intermittent. In other words, even in a place that has a tremendous wind farm with its huge wind resources, and we can see it on a map at the U.S. Department of Energy website, you can still have a couple of days that aren't windy even in those places. We have that here in Texas. We're one of the biggest or perhaps the biggest wind state in the country. And so you always have to have some kind of a backup system, and that's a problem. That's something we need to resolve before wind becomes a mainstay in our electricity system.
Oh, okay, and that, in fact, leads to my next question, and this is going to sound dopey, but where is the wind? I mean, why are we focusing on coasts when, in fact, I know there are wind farms in the prairies, for instance?
Well, there's a lot of wind in the prairies, and billionaire T. Boone Pickens has spoken about that a lot. The problem with his concept is that most of us live in the coast. So 50% of Americans live in a coastal territory. If you look forward, because remember, it's going to take us a long time to move to renewable energy and away from the systems we use today, in 2025, 75% of Americans are going to live in a coastal district. So it would make more sense to develop the resource closer to where we use the electricity, because, of course, that's less expensive and more efficient.
President Obama, as we said, announced these rules yesterday. I want you to listen to exactly what he said.
It's estimated that if we fully pursue our potential for wind energy on land and offshore, wind can generate as much as 20% of our electricity by 2030 and create 250,000 jobs in the process, 250,000 jobs in the process, jobs that pay well and provide good benefits. It's a win-win. It's good for the environment. It's great for the economy.
Wow, those numbers sound great. What do you make of those estimates?
Again, he's right. We could get there. You know, people are always talking about how, you know, Denmark is totally totally wind, you know, dependent. In other words, wind is their major source for electricity. But there are certain technologies that we really should pursue if we're serious about wind. And one of those is a technology to store electricity. That is because if it's not windy in a particular wind farm, that's going to be a major supplier to all Americans. We don't want to have a brownout. And so actually the little-known secret about Denmark is they have too much wind sometimes at night, and they have to sell it at a great discount to Germany. And sometimes during the day they don't have enough wind, and so they wind up buying coal-fired electricity back from a neighboring country.
Wow.
And so I'm not saying it's not a great thing, because a lot of the time they're using the wind and it's carbon free, and we need to move in that direction. But we need to understand that a program that would put in extra wind installations is not ultimately the so-called silver bullet solution to our energy problem, unless we're coming up with these new technologies to store electricity, which we would also benefit solar energy.
I want to quickly talk about the visuals here. Most of us, I think, when we think of wind turbines, think of the Cape Cod controversy. Oh, Walter Cronkite and Ted Kennedy saying they didn't want to look at them. They're not alone in that. So how will this be addressed?
Well, there's no way to address that. I mean, there's no free lunch. I always like to tell Americans to just sit down for a minute of silence right this second and think about the fact that when you flip the switch, there's a fuel going through a power station. I mean, electricity seems invisible. That makes us think it's clean. It makes us think the fuel is invisible. But everything has something. You know, we have a lot of hydroelectric power in the United States, which is a wonderful thing because it's, again, environmentally friendly. But there's a group of people in the United States who do kayaking who want to turn off all the electric, hydroelectric we have, and they've lobbied Congress.
All right.
And what I say to people is we have to generate the electricity from something. And so it's about choices.
Amy, we're going to have to leave it there. John, cue the wind. That's our guest, Amy Myers Jaffe, director of the Rice University Energy Program. Thanks so much for joining us. And a little more wind, please. I can't get enough of that.
Call me Windy.
Ha, I will.
My wife does.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. Since 1924, there has always been the grand sport of ski jumping in the Winter Olympics.
That's your event?
That's my event. Actually, it isn't, and I'll tell you why. I have ovaries. This is an event that is men only. Now, a group of women ski jumpers from all over the world are organizing to get into the 2010 Games in Vancouver. And here's a jump, John. They're suing the Vancouver Organizing Committee to get on the slopes. We're going to find out more from Dee Dee Corradini. She's the president of Women's Ski Jumping USA. She's also the former mayor of Salt Lake City. You might remember them as the host of the 2002 Winter Games. All right, Dee Dee, what possible argument is there against having women do ski jumping in the Olympics?
Well, there are official arguments and there are speculations.
Let's start official. Yeah.
The official reasons that the International Olympic Committee gives us are ones where the goalpost keeps changing on us. The first excuse was, well, you haven't had two world championships. Well, the IOC took that requirement out in 2007, so that is no longer an issue.
Okay.
Then they said, well, you don't have universality. Well, what they meant by that is not enough women and not enough nations. But at the very same time in 2006, when they told us no, they let in a brand new sport called skier-cross, where there were only 30 women from 11 nations, where we had 83 women from 14 nations.
So, Dee Dee, what's going on?
Well, if you think about it, the smaller you are and the lighter you are, the further you fly. So women make very good ski jumpers in a sport where it's been a big male macho thing, and money is probably involved somewhere.
Whoa. You're making a very gender-specific sort of... You're saying that a macho attitude is getting in the way of the sport?
Well, there is that attitude among many people that this is a male-dominated sport. We don't want women in it. And there's a lot of money that gets paid. These guys are rock stars in Europe, and they make lots of money. And
how would successful women get in the way of that?
Well, the money would then perhaps be siphoned off to the women if they make good jumpers, too.
Why are you suing the Vancouver Organizing Committee and not the International Olympic Committee?
Because nobody has control over the IOC, and so it would have been pointless to even try. What we did discover, though, is that our argument is very simple. It is that VANOC, the Vancouver Organizing Committee, is a quasi-governmental organization and therefore subject to the laws of Canada, which prohibit discrimination. So if they're going to host an event for men, they have to host one for women.
So quickly, what is your next step here? What should we be looking out for?
Well, we are hoping that the judge gives us a declaration at the end of this trial. It's actually a hearing that says VANOC is subject to the laws of Canada, so if we're going to have a ski jumping event in 2010, we have to include the women. And we're hoping then that the IOC will respect the decision of the court.
All right. Dee Dee Corradini, I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Dee Dee Corradini, president of Women's Ski Jumping USA and former mayor of Salt Lake City. I'm actually stunned, John, that she thinks that it's just a macho attitude.
I want to know is how much farther can they jump than men? A foot? 10 feet? 6 feet?
Has to be a lot.
A lot. That's macho.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
What credit cards do you take? What do you take from credit cards? President Obama is taking on the credit card companies today. Tell us your story of being credit crunched and how you fight back.
My name is Don Merrill. I'm in Salt Lake City. And the credit card companies had been sending me unsolicited convenience checks for several years. And I had sent them dozens, and I mean dozens, of certified letters asking them to stop. So finally, I took them to court. I sued them, and I won. It was the equivalent of sticking a stick in their eye, but I think that they got the point.
We should have that guy on the show.
Wow.
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thank you, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. New jobless claims figures now are up to 640,000. Continuing claims top 6.1 million. GM will close most plants for 9 weeks this summer. That's according to sources who spoke with the Associated Press. GM won't publicly announce the plan until workers have been told. It will stop production on all but its most popular models, and workers could find out the specifics of the shutdown today under union contracts. They would still get most of their pay, even if they're not required to work. A supplementary vitamin has been linked to the deaths of 21 prize polo horses earlier this week. That's what the leader of the Venezuelan-owned team told an Argentine newspaper. He says that they were given a supplement known as Biodil, which contains a combination of vitamin B12 and some other minerals. Veterinarian Zachary Franklin, who specialises in treating horses, says that the horse's physical reaction was not typical of what you'd expect from a commercially available product.
I wouldn't expect 21 out of 21 animals to be given something and die from it. My guess would be that there was something in that drug that was compounded or contaminated.
Ryoodil is given to horses to help with exhaustion. The drug is not approved for use in the United States, but it is widely used elsewhere. Overseas, the European Union says that donors at international conference there have pledged more than $250 million in aid to Somalia. Somalia wants to use the donations to create a coast guard to fight pirate gangs. And the head of the UN says that it's too dangerous to send UN forces to Somalia right now. And meanwhile, 18 Somali pirates were in court in Kenya today. Sri Lanka has pleaded for international help in what it calls an emergency humanitarian situation. A medical relief group warned that civilian casualties are rapidly rising in the civil war. Robert Templer from the International Crisis Group has asked the United Nations to step in. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So we began this hour talking with our friend John Fox. He says there are few jobs in his area of North Carolina that he hasn't applied for. He's out of work in the construction trades. He'd like to move where there are some jobs, but he can't. Can't sell his house. He's trapped. Our partners at the New York Times are reporting that a lot of Americans are in John Fox's situation. A lower percentage of Americans moved last year than at any time since 1962. What does it all mean? For more, we're joined by New York Times reporter Sam Roberts, who writes all about demographics. We're really seeing demographics, Sam, fused with the economic downturn in this economy in this story, right?
John, that's absolutely true. Well, one of the things we're seeing now is that people are stuck in their homes. They're unable or unwilling to sell their houses at fire sale prices that ordinarily would have a much bigger impact on the economy, because one of the things that American mobility has been so good in providing is getting people to where the jobs are. That's a little mitigated this time because, as John Fox points out, there are no jobs. So he doesn't have any place to move to, and he can't move.
So the first time, this is the lowest moving rate since 1962. I mean, Americans are always described as a very, very mobile culture. There's got to be more to this story, though, than just the economic downturn this year. This is a trend that's been going on for a while.
That's absolutely true. It's the lowest rate, actually, since back in the late 1940s, the lowest number since 1962. And the number and the rate have both been going down, particularly the rate, for a couple of decades. And there are reasons for that, a number of reasons. One, the aging of the population. Typically, people move when they're in their 20s and 30s. Two-earner families have been increasing, which means it's much tougher for both spouses to find jobs someplace else. The home ownership rate has been increasing, and one thing that's done is make people a little bit less mobile. So all of those things have sort of conspired to make us a much less mobile society, sort of dampening the wanderlust that Americans typically have.
And the fact that these homeowners can't sell their homes, even in the midst of a housing bubble burst like this, means they're trapped. So as home ownership rates come down, still people can't necessarily move. Talk about the moving industry itself. There are all kinds of industries and sectors of the economy that depend on moving. What's happening to them?
Well, that's true. There's an economic impact on that, not just on movers, but on all the people they employ, on people who do renovations in houses, people who sell and manufacture durable goods, like appliances in particular, that people are more likely to buy for their new homes. So the decline in mobility itself has an economic impact, and movers all across the country are saying that decline is pronounced. It's something they've never seen to this extent before, particularly in interstate moves, which are made primarily when people retire and even more so when people switch jobs. They move between states.
You know, I'm not a demography expert like you are, Sam, but I was looking at these numbers. In 2008, the Census Bureau says 35.2 million people changed residences. And the year before it was 38.7. That's a huge number.
It is a huge number. It's about 11 or so percent of the population. And Americans still move at rates that are much higher than people in other developed countries. But that percent has been going down. And it goes down from a peak, a modern peak, of about 20%, twice the rate that we're moving now, as recently as the 1980s.
You know, what we've seen in a lot of these economic downturn stories is how much elasticity exists in the U.S. economy. For instance, in the housing market, so much of demand was propped up by refinancing, people flipping homes, speculators buying multiple homes. And as that gets sort of skimmed off the top and you get down to the basic sort of people who want to buy homes, you know, the demand is much, much less. There's a lot of elasticity in this moving number as well. If we're at 11% and we're at a historic low from 1962, there's a lot farther that we could actually go down, right?
There is indeed. And when you look at those interstate moves, which are a good barometer of people changing jobs, that numerically there were fewer interstate movers last year than any year since 1950, when the nation's population was about half of what it is today. That's an enormous jump, and it's half the rate recorded as recently as the beginning of this decade.
Does this benefit the cities or benefit the suburbs or neither?
Well, you know, you can make an argument that the cities are a little more stable, that people are less likely to abandon neighborhoods, but it also creates a certain static condition. Home ownership is very good in terms of stability, but it also, as we say in the story, strands people.
I know you also took a look at immigration numbers and not just migration numbers domestically. What do you see there?
Well, Catherine, that's true, too. Immigration from overseas is the lowest in more than a decade. It's still fairly high. It's still over a million, but it's been dropping. And in part, that's a factor of jobs. It often is a reflection of immigration laws and other global events. But in this case, people are not coming to some extent because the jobs aren't here.
Sam, before we go, you know, we talk a lot about buy locally and energy efficiency and all of that. Would it just be better somehow if Americans stayed put? Would that produce over the long haul some benefits for the economy or no?
I don't think so. I mean, you can point to some benefits, but if you talk to economists, Joe Tracy, research director at the Federal Reserve Bank, who I talked to yesterday, says that less mobility is a serious problem because it means people are not getting matched to their jobs. The labor market starts to improve, and it will. If mobility stays low, you worry about the allocation of workers finding the jobs that best suit them. And that mobility has often been a very important factor in the vitality of the American economy.
Well, get a hold of the New York Times or go online and look at the numbers. Our partners at the New York Times are reporting fewer Americans moved last year than at any time since 1962, directly related to the housing slump. Sam Roberts reported the story. Thanks so much, Sam.
Thank you, John and Catherine.
We know what makes you move when you open up that credit card bill. President Obama's taking on the credit card companies today. You do it every day. So tell us your story of being credit crunched. How do you fight back?
This is James from Northville. I'm choosing not to participate in the recession by paying cash for everything. So I don't have any large credit card bills or interest payments on those.
Oh, I bet you didn't know you had a choice about participating in the recession. Maybe you're thinking what this guy is thinking.
I wish everybody would stop the whining. Credit cards are like any other thing that you buy. You have the ability to drop your credit card and go find a lower interest rate. You have the ability to not use your credit card. You have the ability to shop around for the best rate. So take charge of your life and stop complaining.
Did you hear that, John? Come on, snap out of it.
I like complaining. I like to complain.
Here's what we like. We like to hear your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email
Don't call
us
it.
At mytakeatthetakeaway.org. If you missed anything in the show, go get our podcast.
No,
and if you want to hear more whining,
it.
You go to
Forget it.
John Hockenberry. I'm Catherine Lamb.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Is the caller there? Ali from Darfur?
I got a lot of family members here dying in Darfur. Government bombing by airplane. Government burning the villages. Government helping the Janjaweed by machine gun, by everything, by money, financial, to kill the people. So how going to be the genocide? I don't know the genocide meaning more.
The meaning of genocide and the horrors of Darfur. Does history help or get in the way of humanitarian aid in Sudan's civil war? Saviors and survivors on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. This Thursday, April 23rd, I'm John Hockenberry. Catherine Lamper is in for Adore You Dudgy. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, John. Also up this hour, we're going to talk to Senator Chris Dodd about credit, and we're going to hear more about your stories. Plus, we'll check in on a conference on Somalia. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
New jobless claims just in from the Labor Department. They rose more than expected last week to 640,000, and the number of people who continued to file for unemployment benefits topped 6.1 million. President Obama meets today with leaders from the credit card industry to push for more consumer protection. Critics call the industry's fees and interest rate policies abusive, and both houses of Congress are mulling over legislation that would limit those practices. General Motors will close most plants for 9 weeks this summer, according to sources who spoke with the Associated Press. GM won't publicly announce the plan until workers have been given the specifics. Economist Peter Morici says GM is on the brink of bankruptcy.
With car sales down below 10 million a year, they've lost a lot of market share, and they simply have too many cars to sell, as does Chrysler.
GM will stop production on all but its most popular models. Finding a popular model is a bit of a challenge. Catherine?
Some breaking news out of Iraq this morning. A second suicide bombing there, the latest one killing at least 20. Another struck a Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad, killing at least 22 and injuring more than 60 people. Pakistan paramilitary platoons rushed to the northwest city of Bunir today, where they encountered enemy fire. A Pakistani diplomat, Wajid Jamul Hassan, says the country is determined to fight off the Taliban.
The army will handle it and the law enforcing agencies will push them back, and we are determined to fight it out.
There are reports that Taliban militants took control of Bunir, which is near the northwestern Swat province, already under Taliban control.
That's the disturbing developments in Pakistan there. Keep your eye out this morning for the existing home sales report. Tomorrow we're going to have the numbers on new home sales, key indicators in the economy. And on Wall Street yesterday, the Dow fell about 1%. It opens today at 78.87. The S&P closed flat and begins trading at 8.44. Futures trading suggests a marginally positive to flat opening on Wall Street in about 30 minutes. President Obama taking on the credit card companies, but you have to do it every day. Open that bill and tell us your story of how credit cards crunch you and how you fight back.
Hello, this is Jason from Brewster. My wife and I called the credit card company bluff. They wanted to raise our interest rate to 18%. We called them. They didn't want to reduce it. They said everybody's raising their rates. All we could do is cancel it, so we canceled it.
Cancel the recession at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your stories of strategies for dealing with credit card companies or what they did to your bill without asking you on The Takeaway.
I'm going to make them an offer he can't refuse.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're following stories in Iraq and Pakistan this morning. Pakistan developments in Swat province. We talked about that earlier this morning. And also two bombings in Iraq, a big spike in violence there. Catherine?
And we're following even more international stories. There is a conference going on in Brussels today for the country of Somalia, led by both the UN and the European Union. Donors have pledged more than $250 million to improve security in the East African country. Earlier this morning, we turned to BBC correspondent Mike Woolridge, who was in Brussels covering the story. When we spoke, I asked Mike if he could tell me what it was that the conference was hoping to fix in the country of Somalia.
They want to fix Somalia, in short, not just what happens on land in Somalia, of course, which has been a pretty dreadful catalogue of disaster and violence and conflict over the last 19 years, but also they want to fix the piracy out at sea at the moment, which, of course, has grabbed most of the world's attention. And one of the ways they believe this can be done is by building up Somalia's own security institutions. There are hardly any to speak of at the moment, but some of this money that's being requested here is to pay for that. And the rest of it is to keep going and indeed to reinforce the African Union peacekeepers who are already in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. So that's the ambitions of this meeting here today.
Well, you mentioned the peacekeepers. Wasn't there some talk at one point of sending EU peacekeepers? Or UN peacekeepers, excuse me?
UN peacekeepers, that's right. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, certainly been under some pressure to agree to a fully-fledged UN force. He said again just yesterday in a report on this that he didn't believe the time was right now because, in his view, there's no peace to keep. So what he's proposing, and he said it again here in Brussels this morning, is a more incremental approach to this. Doesn't rule out a full UN force in the long term, but he believes that for the moment the big thing is to build up the African Union peacekeepers. There's 4,300 of them in Mogadishu at the moment. They want to get them to 5,100 and then eventually to 8,000. But again, crucially, to want to go along with Somalia's new president, moderate Islamist.
Who's at the conference?
Sheikh Ahmed, who's at the conference. He arrived a little late, but came in and gave his own view of all of this, saying that he too wants to build up a national army, a national security force, he's calling it, and also a 10,000-strong police force. And it's for that that they're looking for the funds. The whole question, of course, is whether that could conceivably happen on anything like the timescale that could address the piracy offshore and do very much to win the confidence of Somalis. One of the fears here is there's a big gap between the intentions, the maybe laudable ambitions of this conference and the reality on the ground.
All right. Mike Woolridge with our partner, the BBC. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to go now to Bronwyn Brutan. She is an expert on Somalia, a longtime observer with the Council on Foreign Relations. She's going to join us from Washington. And Bronwyn, Mike was just mentioning that there is some mix of expectations here about what they want to do with this conference and what is actually achievable. And so, Mike, first question for you is, what can really happen here?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question. There's no doubt about it. You know, the donors, all of them, the United States, to the EU, to Britain, to Ethiopia, I think, are really unsure about what the next step in Somalia should be. There's a lot of optimism about this unity government because the president, Sheikh Ahmed, is someone who has managed to bring some form of governance to Somalia in the past. But at the same time, he's really an unknown quantity. He's had ties to people who are suspected to be terrorists. He's running a government with no capacity whatsoever. We're not really sure about, you know, his ability to mobilize Somalis at this point. So there's just a really big question mark. And this conference is really, I think, intended to send a signal to Somalia that the international community is watching and is waiting and is willing to invest if there's something to invest in.
Bronwyn, isn't there another way to phrase this, which is that the international community is finally paying attention now that pirates took a ship with an American flag?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you could say that we've been paying attention since 2006 when Somalia was taken over by what we suspected to be an extremist Islamic movement.
Well, paying attention.
And that, of course, led to the invasion by Ethiopia.
Right. I mean, paying attention, what does that mean? I mean, from the standpoint of a citizen in the Horn of Africa, it seems to me that, oh, wow, now the West is paying attention, now that some drug-addled teenagers are taking AK-47s to some container ships, responsible for Western cargo. I mean, it seems to me that this conference just reinforces a lot of cynicism and can't conceivably get anything done.
You know, that is absolutely the fear. You know, we're talking primarily in this conference about building up security forces. And when we say security forces, we're talking about, you know, the same kind of young guys with guns who are committing piracy activities.
Right.
On the Gulf. On Monday, for example, these TFG forces had a traffic accident in Mogadishu, like a fender bender, and they opened fire on a civilian minibus. They shot 8 people and killed 2 of them. And we're talking about strengthening this kind of a force, which is a really difficult proposition.
So what are some of the other danger points we have to look out for?
Well, the danger points are almost too many to mention. You have a population that basically has been radicalized by this invasion. You know, we really do give Somalis the impression that all we care about is terrorism and piracy when we ignore the country for 10 years and then really try to change their system of government by force. And then again, sort of turn the other way when the situation deteriorates until there's something like piracy that comes up and forces us to reinvest. Now, we have a national security imperative in Somalia, of course, and our capacity to constructively limit events is very limited. You know, there's not a lot that we can do in Somalia given the resources that we have to invest in that country. But we really do need to pay more attention about our public relations there. And we need to try hard to make the Somalis understand that we're not out to get them. And I'm not sure we're doing a good job of that right now.
Yeah, I remember when the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, after the latest piracy incident, came out with a rather thoughtful statement talking about how what we really need to do is make this a country that can run again to aid the economy. So it sounds like what we're talking about right now is beefing up the security. But what steps, if any, do we see about helping to shore up a country where people turn to piracy to make a living?
Yeah, I mean, this is the fundamental problem that I have with American policy in Somalia, which is that we've always looked at Somalia's problems as stemming from a lack of government. And our efforts in Somalia have always been directed at creating a government. And then we thought about economic assistance as a distant or second or third or fourth priority. Right now we're looking at security because we want a force that can defeat Islamic extremists in the country and pirates. And we're supporting the government to that end. But what we really need to do is be thinking about stability that can lead to economic growth. Well, and that's how we're going to solve these problems.
But you know, even though the numbers, they're talking about $260 million that's supposed to improve security. I mean, that's a paltry sum compared with what the governments of the world are talking about, either in terms of aid or restoring the economic health of the world. When I was in Somalia in the early 90s, what people in Somalia were saying was that the chaos and the famine that was going on in Somalia at that time was destroying the tribal networks that had been around and had been responsible for local stability for hundreds of years, and that once that was gone, there was no getting it back with any sort of security force, that basically something was going to have to be regrown from the grassroots, and no amount of money is going to be able to do that. Bronwyn?
But, you know, to be honest with you, I think that that's actually happened. In that 10-year period from the time that, you know, we had our disaster with Black Hawk Down to 2006 when the Islamic Courts Union rose up, there was a period of regrowth in Somalia. And if you look at the local politics, traditional leaders and religious leaders and local leaders are playing a very important role. And all of our attention is on the national government, which is a disaster. But if you look a little deeper, I think there's a lot of governance in Somalia and a lot of people we can work with very effectively.
And what are the mechanisms for getting aid to those people and those institutions?
Well, that's the thing. We have to create those mechanisms. I think it's important to support a national government to a certain extent, but we do also need to be giving direct aid to clan leaders and to district leaders. And we can do that via local and international NGOs. And there are programs in place that the UN is running, that USAID is running, that already do exactly that. So we're not really starting from scratch here.
All right, Bronwyn, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Our guest, Bronwyn Bruton. She's an expert on Somalia with the Council of Foreign Relations, and she joined us from Washington, John.
Oh, the very serious challenges there. We'll see what happens now that Somalia is in the headlines with piracy and what they can do in the EU. We're talking about credit card credit crunching, what credit card tactics infuriate you the most at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd is coming up a little later. Yeah. He's going to address this along with the Obama administration today as Congress takes up credit card regulation.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adora Udoji today. President Obama is taking on the credit companies this morning, but hey, we're thinking you could tell him a thing or two about being credit crunched. what have the companies done for you lately?
Can you somebody explain why the government allowed credit card companies to have late interest rates hit the ceiling? There's no limit to what they can charge the consumer. And unfortunately, what that does is compounds the debt.
We'd like to compound your stories and gather more of them. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
For thousands of people in the United States, the issues in Sudan and Darfur raise a moral imperative. People participating in a rally in San Francisco in April, Save Darfur. It's become a rallying cry among American liberals, conservatives, Muslims, Jews, and Christians that the conflict in the region should be stopped and that the regime, which in Sudan has already been issued an arrest warrant by the World Court in The Hague. Sudan's president stands accused of war crimes, but he's still in office. Should there be regime change and massive international intervention in Sudan? We're now here with Mahmoud Mamdani, professor of government at Columbia University, author of the controversial Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Does the profile of Darfur in the United States, particularly among liberals and those protesters that you heard there, help in discovering or finding an international policy that's going to assist the people of Sudan to end this brutality?
Well, look, concern has to be based on information. The commander of the UN forces in Darfur reports that throughout the year 2008, the number of civilians that died in Darfur is roughly around 1,500. That is less than 135 a month. That is less than what the UN would consider an emergency in any other part of the world. Those organized by Save Darfur in the U.S. do not know this. The media does not report on this. The fact is that the level of violence, which was high in 2003-2004, dipped very low starting January 2005, which means this is an opportunity for a political resolution of the conflict, not for talking about an external intervention.
So is the numbers themselves an argument against calling what's going on in Darfur genocide?
Well, the numbers tell us what the trend is. They tell us that the level of violence is going down. They also tell us another thing. They tell us that the causes of death are multiple. Violence is one of them. A larger cause is the effect of drought and desertification. They also tell us, if we care to learn about the history of the conflict, they tell us that the conflict began before the present government even came into power. It began in 1987-89 with the worst effects of the violence, drought and desertification, which pushed northern nomads down south and initiated a conflict around the best land in the south of Darfur.
Although, Professor, we've seen again and again in Africa that external climatic changes have political consequences in the sense that competition for resources is reflected in politics and brutality against certain groups, and the displaced groups in Sudan may be an example of this.
Well, the thing is that in most complex conflicts, there are multiple causes. Here you have the environmental change, then you have a land system which deprives certain groups of land, starting from the early colonial period, and then you have the effects of the civil war in Chad, which again in the mid 80s became a war that got integrated into the Cold War. The Reagan administration, France and Israel supported one side. Gaddafi and the Soviet Union supported the other side. The opposition crossed the border into Darfur, where it armed and trained. And precisely when Darfur had not a drop of water in the mid-80s, it was awash with guns. The big powers got involved even before the government of Sudan got involved in Darfur.
Well, Professor, the question really is in the eye of the beholder. You know, the violence can look like, the workings out of history, but it can also look like genocide, depending on who you are. Here's a man named Ali, who called into a radio program that you were a guest on here on the WNYC last March. His name is Ali, and he claims that there is genocide in Darfur. Listen and then respond, please.
Me, myself, from Darfur, I got a lot of family members, he died in Darfur. Government bombing by airplane, government burn the villages. Government helping the Janjaweed by machine gun, by everything, by money, financial, to kill the people. So how going to be the genocide? I don't know the genocide meaning what.
That man says he doesn't know the meaning of genocide based on the analysis that you were giving. What's your response?
Well, everything that Ali says is true. And everything he says was true in 1987-89. And in fact, the word genocide was used by one side in 87 at the 1989 reconciliation conference. And the word ethnic cleansing was used by the other side. It was a brutal civil war in 87-89 and then a brutal insurgency and counterinsurgency in 2003-2004. None of what he says would be true today. As I said, from January 2005, the level of violence has dropped, but an opportunity is being missed. I think the African situation shows that when you have an ongoing conflict, which is sort of simmering year after year, you have to look for a political solution, and that political solution is not taking people to court.
But isn't there also the danger, Professor, that history and a looking at the causes and a focus on the complexity of the conflict possibly threatens to, you know, repeat what happened in Rwanda, where a hesitation on the part of the international community really amplified the violence?
Well, I think we need to revisit Rwanda. Save Darfur is telling its supporters that the lesson of Rwanda is that there's no point in talking about causes of conflicts, that in fact by the time we figured out who were Hutu and who were Tutsi and why Hutu were killing Tutsi, the Tutsi were dead. It's like telling somebody that if a person is critically ill and you bring a doctor, you tell the doctor there's no point in diagnosis, just prescribe. And then going a step further and saying the prescription should be given by the most outraged and the most concerned person, information doesn't matter. Well, that simply is the wrong conclusion to draw from Rwanda. The fact is that in Rwanda, there was a political conference in Arusha, and the conference did not hold because certain groups in Rwanda were left out of the conference, and those groups had absolutely no interest in implementing the results of the conference.
So the notion of repeating the experience of Rwanda is itself complex, and possibly caution is prescribed. Mahmoud Mamdani, we're going to leave it there. Professor of Government at Columbia University and author of Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics and the War on Terror. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
It's time now to go to headlines in the newsroom with Femi Oke.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is 32 minutes past the hour. Good morning, all. The Labour Department says that initial claims for unemployment rose to 640,000. That's up about 4% from last week. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had a moment of candour at the State Department yesterday after unveiling an impressive programme of environmentally friendly initiatives at the State Department to celebrate Earth Day. Clinton admitted it's not easy being green.
I'm very excited by all of the possibilities ahead of us. And, you know, oftentimes when you face such an overwhelming challenge as global climate change is, it can be somewhat daunting. It's kind of like trying to lose weight, which I know something about.
So Secretary Clinton describes the efforts of the State Department around the world as greening diplomacy best achieved by baby steps. And she says her own personal challenge is to avoid the candy at environmental conferences that she has to attend. Championship.
That's really important. Yeah.
It's not her biggest challenge. It's just, you know, trying to be human, relate, connect. Championship polo matches are now scheduled to resume in Florida today after 21 prize horses from a Venezuelan-owned team mysteriously died. The leader of the team told an Argentine newspaper all the horses were given a supplementary vitamin known as Biodil. The supplement is not approved for horses in the US, but it's widely used elsewhere. And finally, President Obama is pushing for more legal protection for the millions of Americans who use credit cards. He will meet with industry leaders today to tackle what critics call abusive fees and interest charges. Legislation in both chambers of Congress right now propose a credit card bill of rights. As a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. In about 15 minutes, Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd is going to be one of those lawmakers taking up some of that agenda on changing the credit card industry. You know, in this economy, a lot of Davids, a lot of Goliaths, maybe more Davids than Goliaths. But once upon a time, there was Enron. You remember Enron? They were the big evil. There was AIG.
Don't forget Madoff.
We've still got Madoff, I think. And as you heard from Femi today, the Goliath. Well, I got one word for you. Plastic. Well, if you do have those credit cards, you are David. And President Obama is talking with the heads of 14 companies that issue those credit cards today. And, you have to handle credit card companies and their regulatory fees every single day, don't you?
I had credit troubles a long time ago, and the way that I solved them was I calculated what the minimum payment would be if my card was maxed out and set up my bank to automatically send that amount to my credit card company every month. And it worked great for 3 years. And I got a letter that they were changing the date of my due date, and I didn't think much about it. All of a sudden, I start getting a late payment almost every other month. One time, I got 2 late payments in a row.
We're getting some amazing and some appalling stories on what credit card companies are doing to you.
Oddly enough, my husband and I just got a notice that the limit on our credit card was increased by another $5,000. Not that we're going to use it, I hope, but I just thought it was very strange when my son is having a hard time getting a college loan, all of a sudden the same bank is giving us all of this extra credit.
Whether you've got bad credit or good credit, is it the computers or are the companies just after your money, period?
My credit card company, which is Bank of America, just sent me a letter stating that they're going to raise my interest rate significantly for absolutely no reason other than the fact that they can. And this is a bank that needed a bailout and received a bailout, and now this is what they're doing to their loyal customers.
Well, Judy considers herself a loyal customer from Grand Forks, North Dakota. She told us this story. Her credit card company, although they received her payment on the due date, did not open the envelope. She didn't know that the credit card company can sit on the payment for 24 hours once they've received it. So not only did the credit card company charge her the late fee, it also bumped up her interest rate, and even though it was there on time. And she's not alone.
I received an offer for 2.99 from Chase for the life of the loan. I received that, of course, after paying their 12 to 20% rates like clockwork for a decade. I maxed that out at 2.99 to pay off higher rate debt. I put the payments on auto debit so I'd never be late. And then Chase just recently raised my minimum payment from 2 to 6%, so it doubled to over $600 a month. And they added a $120 annual fee even if there's no balance.
This is Cindy from Metro Detroit. We have a couple credit cards. One is with American Express, and they sent us a letter saying that they were decreasing our credit line by 20% because we live in Metro Detroit, which is an area hard hit by the hard economic times currently. We never paid it on late, always paid on time, always paid more than the minimum, and always used the card, which is everything that they tell you to do.
Make him an offer he can't refuse.
All right. Here's a story from Nikolai. He disputed a $79 charge that he didn't recognize in a bill in June. And by the time he received a letter from a legal firm on behalf of Citibank, his statements had $1,100 on it, all of which were late fees. He canceled the card in August.
Yeah, well, what makes you really irate are the interest rates themselves.
I got a letter from Bank of America boosting my rate from 5% to 12%, but adding insult to injury was the fine print that said unless I specifically rejected the new rate by calling a number, it would automatically go up. And if I did reject it, if I ever use that card again, they would charge 12% on all new purchases as well as my outstanding balance under the old rate.
Basically, you're mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore.
Hi, this is Michael from Brooklyn. My wife is a genius CFO of this family, and we never carry a balance on any of our credit cards, so the interest can go away.
I don't know about you. I want a CFO in my family.
It'll work.
James in Rhode Island emails us and says that if you want to tackle credit cards and what effect they have on you, he would like there to be a two-tiered system. So if you pay with credit, you get one price in the store, but if you pay with cash, you get less. This will encourage people to save up money for big purchases, he says, like our grandparents.
Got any ideas for Senator Dodd, who's coming right up here?
My takeaway on credit cards is very simple. The easiest way to solve all these problems, including payday loans, credit cards, and these predatory credit cards, is outlaw usury. Anything over 24% would be defined as a crime nowadays.
Like usury, I think is
the
word.
Yeah, but you know,
put the bums in jail.
We know what he means. But, you know, John, let's leave it on a softer note.
No.
Because even on rare occasions, credit card companies aren't your enemy.
Put the bums in jail.
Sometimes they're your frenemy.
I'm calling about a good experience I had with a credit card. I missed one. I was late on one payment, and they took away a good promotional rate that I had, a low rate, and they charged me an extra fee, and I called them up. And because this was my first late payment, and I've always paid on time, and try to pay a few dollars extra every month, they reversed it. They gave me back my low promotional rate, and they took away the fees.
Did you hear that? Did you hear that, John?
They
took away the fees. Ah, so heartwarming.
Your story's at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Okay, John, who can forget in January when Captain Sully Sullenberg landed that plane on the Hudson River? Remember?
That was dramatic. That was dramatic.
No, that was caused, of course, by a bird strike.
The pilot landed the plane. The bird did not land the plane.
But the whole thing happened because the plane hit a flock, or the Canadian geese hit the plane.
Right.
Pilot had to ditch everything in the river. Since then, the FAA has proposed keeping information about bird strikes, such as where and when they happen, a secret.
A secret?
I know. I don't get the story.
The birds
either.
Are like from Al-Qaeda or something?
Yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said no to that plan. He says the public has a right to know. We're going to turn now to Bruce Holmes. He worked on air transportation systems. He was a former chief strategist at NASA's Langley Research Center. He's now president of Holmes Consulting, and he's a pilot. He joins us from Williamsburg, Virginia. All right, Mr. Holmes, I have to ask you, why would we even have a need to keep bird strike data secret?
Good morning. This is an interesting question. I can't do anything other than speculate, perhaps, that there were some concerns in the regulatory organizations that there would be some recrimination or some kind
against
of
the birds? I mean, yeah. Truly, I don't understand.
Well, I think they get their recrimination right up front. The challenge is, you know, making information available, which is absolutely vital. I mean, that's how we mitigate any risk over the long term is sharing data, and so that's got to be done.
Now, as we mentioned, you are a pilot. Can you give us a description? What's it like when you're in a bird strike? And please, no sound effects.
No visual aids either. I've over the 40 some odd years I've been flying airplanes, I've been involved in two bird strikes. I remember, I guess the most notable one was flying an open cockpit biplane and getting hit in the helmet. It was actually something of a non-event. I mean, I knew it happened and knew afterwards on the ground more or less what kind of bird it probably was.
I'm wondering if this information is transparent, if there's some fear that consumers will be, if they find out how often it actually happens, it will have some sort of chilling effect on air travel, or maybe there'll just be more questions about bird strikes.
Well, I think consumers are a pretty intelligent lot, by and large, and they learn how to adapt to many sort of uncertainties out there, and whether it's bird strikes or deer strikes.
But, Bruce, what's the scuttlebutt? I mean, do pilots have this idea that there are airports that are, like, really bad for bird strikes, and, you know, maybe we're going to learn about that?
We're going to learn that, you know, every airport has its own story. And if there's a trash dump next to one airport and the other airport.
Interesting.
Oh.
You know,
so you get seagulls one place and you don't get them another. If you're on a flyway migrating waterfowl, that creates a different sort of probability than at an airport where the ducks and geese don't come around.
All right. Bruce Holmes, I want to thank you so much for getting up and joining us. Bruce Holmes, a pilot, president of Holmes Consulting. And a reminder, the bird strike data is available online tomorrow, John, and we're going to have it at thetakeaway.org. So you can go ahead and look up those airports that you...
Oh, okay. Oh, the birds are in. They're in here. They got in the studio.
Tippy, get John Tippy. Oh, poor Tippy Hedren. Oh, hate that movie.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So in a moment, Senator Christopher Dodd will talk about what the government is going to be doing regarding credit card regulation. Is it possible? We'll find out right after headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Pakistan paramilitary platoons rushed to the northwest city of Bunia today, where they encountered enemy fire. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the situation poses a mortal threat to U.S. security.
We cannot underscore the seriousness of the existential threat posed to the state of Pakistan that are being made by a loosely confederated group of terrorists and others who are seeking the overthrow of the Pakistani state.
There are reports that Taliban militants took control of the city, which is near the northwestern Swat province, which they already control. Earlier this month, the Pakistani government agreed to impose Islamic law in Swat in a deal with the Taliban. There's more evidence in the Craigslist killing in Boston. Police searched the apartment of the Boston University medical student charged with killing a woman who placed a Craigslist ad for massage services. An official says that they found personal items that belonged to that woman and to others. And officials told ABC News they think he may have been collecting souvenirs from the victims. The morning after pill will soon be available over the counter to 17-year-olds. The FDA overturned a Bush administration policy yesterday that denied over-the-counter access to those under 18. And that shift comes after a federal district court judge had ordered the FDA to change its policy. And finally, today is William Shakespeare's birthday.
Go Willie, it's your birthday. Go Willie, it's
rare, birthday. Rare recording of William Shakespeare?
Well, absolutely. He's 445 today. The city of Chicago are observing a Talk Like Shakespeare Day. Go to talklikeshakespeareday.org and you'll find a guide on how to do it.
I wish you hadn't said that.
He wasn't Sarah much on Hockenberry. Rhymes. He wasn't much on rhymes. He had great rhythm.
Mistress Prithee, sir. Prithee. Is it time to move on?
All right, hold on, guys. Here we go. We've been talking about credit card regulations and the possibility of the federal government stepping in and dealing with some of those fees in your credit card bills. Well, joining us to talk about the legislative initiatives that might address some of the concerns of our listeners we've been hearing all morning is Democratic Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut. Senator Dodd, thanks so much for being with us.
Not at all. Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk, first of all, about what can be done here. I thought credit cards were already regulated.
Well, not really. They are to some degree, I suppose, but some of the rates that get charged, you would have gone to jail. This is what we're called, usurious rates, almost organized crime rates, shown what they call loan shark rates a few years ago. And about a year or so ago, the Federal Reserve Bank, at long last, issued some regulations on credit cards, which were very positive and moved us in the right direction. But, of course, those regulations could be changed overnight in a new administration. They don't go far enough, and they don't go into effect until July of next year. And as a result, I've tried for over 20 years, but frankly, the credit card industry has been so strong that I've never been able to get much more than 20 or 30 votes on some of the things we're now very close to achieving, which will provide some of the protections that your callers in have been raising issues about. And that's the good news, and I'm grateful the President today is meeting with these credit card companies and issuers and is going to be supporting, I think, some strong legislative efforts, which we hope to be able to take in the next few weeks, that will finally put some very strong consumer protections on the use of credit cards.
Now, of course, the credit card industry includes some banks with very familiar names, but it also includes some institutions that have less familiar names. But let's talk about Citibank, for instance, and Bank of America. We've heard those names this morning. It seems to me that on paper, the government has assisted Bank of America to get into a situation where it gets money from the Federal Reserve, from the TARP, at about what interest rate, Senator?
Oh, John, the rate is, I don't know, what is it, 4%, 5%, 6%, something like that. It's very low.
Is it even that high?
It might not be that high.
Yeah, I think it may be like 1% or something. It's practically free money they're getting from the TARP, and they're charging on their Bank of America credit cards interest rates of 18, 19, 20%.
That's... Well, to give you an idea, just since March of last year, between March of last year and February of this year, 70 million accounts had their interest rates raised. I'm told that's like one out of four families. In many cases, the rates were raised. You can read through all the fine print, but at the end of all the fine print, you'll commonly find the following language. We reserve for ourselves the right to raise rates for at any time for any reason. And so the stories are not just anecdotal that you've heard and that I've heard over and over again of people who for years, I had a couple in Connecticut the other day, they were 3 days late for the first time in 18 years, small business, Samantha Moore and her husband. They did a press conference with me. I don't mind using their names. They wanted them reused. And they were 3 days late, got a notice. Their rates went from like 11% up to something like 20%. And they reduced their credit lines from $31,000 down to $4,000. This is a small business family. So all of a sudden, they're not only finding an increase in rate, but all of a sudden their credit lines have substantially dropped, which means they can borrow less as a small business in a critical time. Also putting their credit rating across a great risk. If they go over that 4,000, then, of course, they'll start getting terrible credit reports, and their business is put in further jeopardy. Just one example of what goes on every day.
It's a great story, but I have to say, Senator, you helped to create this situation. I mean, when the TARP is available to Bank of America, they get more free money. They can raise interest rates and get more money on the back end. Wouldn't it have been better to just let Bank of America go down, let the people default on their balances? They get to pay less of a penalty for that. Maybe there's a credit card hit, a credit card or credit rating hit, but the banks don't get these like windfall profits.
Well, we're drifting off a little bit. I mean, the reason for the TARP money was to keep a financial system in play.
Credit cards are the financial system.
Well, it's part of it. I'm a strong so credit cards are a great vehicle for people, obviously, and they've been well used and properly maintained, and that is with the banks not charging outrageous rates and so forth, they can really be of great help to people, not opposed to credit cards at all. But there's a difference here in talking about whether or not you've got any banks at all for a financial system to operate and whether or not credit card issuers are charging rates and fees and penalties which are excessive, and I think they are, and that's why we're passing the legislation.
What's the interest rate that you think is appropriate for credit cards?
Well, you can certainly see the credit unions, I think, have a cap of around 12%, 12 or 15%. They never go above that. I think that's a law, in fact, that doesn't allow them to go any excess of that. And certainly you can see where people incur great risk or something that a lending institution might want the opportunity to raise some rates. But to raise rates in the level we're talking about here, as I said a few years ago, those were illegal rates. You could go to jail for charging those rates.
All right. Even if we do cap it at 12%, and again, you're going to be considering a whole range of regulations, isn't there a fundamental contradiction here in the sense that to get the economy moving again, the Fed, Bernanke, Tim Geithner, you, Barney Frank, are saying we need more credit. We need people to borrow. We need banks to lend. But that also runs the risk of getting us back into this situation where people get overly indebted with too easy credit and we're back into this bubble situation once again.
Well, obviously people need to borrow. We understand that. And people need to consume. We understand that 70% of our GDP depends upon the gross domestic product, depends upon consumption. And clearly credit has to flow again, and that's not working in order for our financial system to work. But also there has to be some responsibility. And I'm not exculpating, that is forgiving consumers. Consumers have to be careful as well. But obviously if you're losing your job, a major health care problem hits the family, then you don't often have the option of being responsible in all this. You're trying to make ends meet and keep your nose above water. So obviously if you can get credit moving, people can borrow. Businesses borrow as a regular matter for paying their employees, buying inventory. Then they count on revenues coming in to meet those responsibilities. The financial system and the credit flow is absolutely critical for our economic well-being and stability and competence building. So obviously that's what we're trying to do. There are various efforts being made by the Obama administration, and I applaud them for trying. The other side is just saying no to everything. That's a good political answer, but it doesn't really get you very far. So I admire what Geithner's trying to do here. It's not perfect. It hasn't worked as well as you and I would like it to work. But we're seeing some signs that things are getting better. Not great, but there are some signs that we're moving in the right direction. And I think that's what people are looking for and why I think people are at least at this juncture, being supportive of President Obama's effort.
But I think people have the impression that the government is a better advocate for bankers than it is for consumers, like the people whose stories you just told.
All right, and hence one of the reasons why we've been talking about all this top-down stuff over the last number of months, and it's about time we start talking about some bottom-up. That is, how do we help consumers meet their responsibilities, not be saddled with over excessive costs on credit cards and the like, see that we can deal with foreclosure mitigation so that people can stay in their homes and get the rates down, get some of the principal reduced so that we don't end up with the 10,000 foreclosures every day we're witnessing in the country. So those efforts, I think, are critically important.
And it's all going to be on the legislative agenda. Senator Chris Dodd, thanks for joining us from his home state of Connecticut. Thank you very much, Senator Dodd.
Now, Senator Dodd says he's taking on credit card companies, but what about you? What's been happening to you? Are they shortening your grace period, upping your APR, or maybe they've been good to you?
My name is Loretta, and I wanted to say something positive, actually, and I'm referring to the Target stores. I had incurred late fees. They whopped me with like a $50 late fee. I got a letter in the mail from them shortly thereafter saying that they waived it, recognizing that people are having difficulties and that they knew that I had been paying well in the past and that they could tell that I was having problems.
Wow. Tell us your stories at our website, thetakeaway.org. And, of course, if you missed anything, go to our podcast at our website, also thetakeaway.org. Mr. Hockenberry?
Well, the credit card stories keep coming in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We'll see what the federal government comes up with to help consumers. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.